Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode 59, which I had the great pleasure of having Dino Myers Lamptey on. He is the founder and creator of the Barbershop Media Agency. To say it's a media agency would be a little bit unfair because it is more complicated than that. It's more of a strategically led media like agency, basically using technology and creatives together all under one roof. But yes, we had a very interesting conversation to talk about where the state of media currently, where it might be going in the future, as well as other topics as well. He's a very interesting chap, very informative, and I think you'll get a lot from this podcast today. So please sit back, enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, and yeah, have a fantastic day. Peace. Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. This is episode 59. Today, I am quite privileged and happy to have today Dino Myers Lamptey. He is the founder of The Barbershop. I would say it's a media company, but it's much more than that. But I'm not the person to go into that detail. Dino, how are you today? And thank you for being on the show.
I'm very good, thank you. It's another day in lockdown, another busy day in lockdown. But thanks for having me. It's good that we can connect through, you know, devices like this on a Zoom call.
Yes.
And you did a good job of describing, you know, my company, but there is a little bit more to it as well. So, you know, the Barbershop is, I call it a creative company. And the reason why we go beyond just talking about media is we set about to try and solve the full service and full solutions conundrum. So we try and bring, you know, media, creative and technology closer together to provide, you know, real business solutions for clients that are communications led. But the really important part when I describe the company that comes from my background is that we are strategic led. So, you know, we employ strategic thinkers who know how to think as well as do. So they don't just kind of dream up big kind of thoughts and insights, but they also know how to implement them. And importantly, you know, make change happen for the brands that we work with. An important part as well to when we talk about the brands that we work with is we like to work with purpose-led brands, but also brands that bring pleasure into the world and, you know, enrich culture through the pleasure they bring. So we like to think of it as in terms of it's either kind of pleasure, so purpose driven or purpose seeking.
Right, I see. So basically, yes, you do media, but with like creative and tech. So if I was, say, Dollar Shave Club, for instance, so like what would I be like if I went, yes, do me a campaign, but I need it tech led? What would be the sort of things entailed with that?
Yeah, so Dollar Shave Club is quite a good example, actually, because it was a disruptive brand that came into the market, and it had a very different kind of business model. So typically, you know, we talk about brands in a couple of different dimensions, and I mentioned the purpose and pleasure spectrum. We've also got the axes of disruptors with ambition and traditionalists in transition. So those across that spectrum tend to be either kind of small, fast-growing brands that are disrupting markets like Dollar Shave Club were, or the big traditional brands that realize their market has been disrupted. They need to pivot and change direction. So that could be like Gillette or Wilkinson Sword, for example, who have noticed that there's changes at foot in the market. So one of the key ways that technology can help disrupt a market is by changing the model in which it services the market. So for example, you know, whereas people like, you know, Gillette and Wilkinson Swords were traditionally just, you know, a supermarket, for, you know, product effectively, you know, you go into supermarkets and that's where you expect to buy them. You might buy them online, but again, through a retailer, Dollar Shave Club was a direct consumer model. So it allowed you to subscribe and get the products delivered to your door and never see a retailer ever. So, you know, that is a technology solution, which means that, okay, as a brand, you have to have you know, your website and your whole existence has to be completely e-commerce ready. You know, you're probably, your platform is an app rather than a high street retail presence. So a lot of the marketing communication vehicles that you would need typically aren't relevant. You know, in terms of directing people to a specific location just isn't relevant anymore. You know, so you have to think about things in a different way. And actually, if you're a digital brand like that, then a lot of the digital communications and tech-led communication things actually become potentially more feasible for you to use. So whether it is, you know, ordering through, you know, voice-activated technology like Alexa or Siri, things like that, suddenly those all seem very normal to you in your world. And from a communications perspective, whereas most people in the media and advertising industries would talk about solutions of things that can be created that, you know, that are within the traditional remit of, you know, maybe their adverts, basically, you know, adverts. You know, we like to think about things like, actually, hang on a minute, do they need to create a, you know, a chatbot, or do they need to create some kind of voice command technology that is effectively an extension of the product that really just works and allows them to live in all these different environments? And that's a very different kind of skill set. Someone technical, someone, you know, developer skills needs to be on hand, ready to do that. And that doesn't typically fall within the communications landscape, but it is, you know, it affects, you know, it affects the communication.
Yeah, no, this is the thing, like just mentioning that alone, it just says to me there is like so many options to go down. Yeah, you can go down traditional routes, but when you're going down, like, yeah, creating something which is more technological, it's like, that's not just one route in my mind. It's a number of different routes you can go down to sort of deliver a product or delivering a brand. Like, it must be incredibly hard for sort of companies and businesses today to sort of, how can I say, like separate their brand identity from the rest of the pack, because there's most probably so much information out there right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that if there's anything that is consistent in the world, that is, the world is getting much more competitive for any brand that exists in the world. You know, you know, it's when we talk about traditionalists in transition, you know, we talk about brands that have lost their way a little bit. You know, often the biggest brands that, you know, we all know their names, have got there through some kind of market dominance, ultimately a superior product at some point in time that really, you know, satisfied a need and solved the problem. But also they had structural reasons why they had an advantage. They probably had the best distribution, or they were always there when you went into your, you know, your supermarket, or online, they were highest up on Google or whatever it is. And they also had kind of a global presence. So if you went to another country, you recognize the Coca-Cola, you know, logo, brilliant, wonderful, we'll buy it straight away. Nowadays, particularly more so, information and technology is allowing us to, one, get any product we want from anywhere in the world much more easily. But also look into the inner workings of that product, you know, see the reviews, see the background of the company, have a look at, you know, whether they are really doing good, like they say they're doing good. Really understand, you know, so much more than we ever understood before, which is giving, you know, us more choice and therefore making it much more competitive for that brand that exists in that market. Whichever brand that is, you know, they can be suddenly, you know, overnight faced with a myriad of competitors that typically they were protected by their presence and their distribution and their size. You know, people are becoming less loyal to brands in that sense, because they're judging them by how well they perform, but also, you know, do they have kind of like purpose behind what they do?
So would you say right now is the best time, like the best time for sort of the little guy to have much more opportunity over, well, more sort of legacy-led companies right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the rise of the disruptor, you know, and you know, we used to call them challenger brands as well. There's a slight difference. But I think before, being a challenger brand, let's pick a brand like Red Bull or something like that, who were, you know, a phenomenal challenger brand to Coca-Cola. But they had to take incredible risk in terms of, you know, how they set about being what they are. You know, they're an energy drink that had to end up sponsoring people to jump off mountains and, you know, and then you know, whatever, like Formula One and doing events and distribution and just sampling, you know, incredibly difficult effort. But also that you can't forget the nightclub thing with them, you know, vodka Red Bulls. You know, they basically infiltrated lots of different kind of spaces that they weren't, you know, you wouldn't expect to see them. to be like, hang, get you to rethink the whole drink experience, and manage to rise up there on some kind of platform. So people, that's a real challenger approach. People thought they were a lot bigger than they actually were, because of the noise they created. But actually, I think disruptors are, they're much more kind of like purpose-led in their ambition of what the problem they're setting out to solve. So they're just kind of like going, right, well, you know, for a long time, you know, things have been a certain way, but they don't need to be that way anymore. So we're going to change that, and we're going to go straight to consumer. We're going to just change the way that model and that market has worked, because that's what the consumers want, and we're going to give them what they need. And because, you know, we don't have the same limits and, you know, challenges that the market gave us before, we can just do things slightly differently. And a good example of that is someone like, it doesn't sound like a disruptor now, but someone like Netflix is a great example of that. Because, you know, when you look at it on the face of it, it's an incredibly difficult market to break into broadcast as a market. You know, some of the biggest companies in the world dominate that market, and how it's controlled in terms of, you know, how you buy shows and the talent network and where they can be distributed and all that kind of stuff. It's an industry that was completely locked down and nearly impossible for any small new player to come about. And but Netflix, you know, ultimately realized that they could come in as a disruptor and change the idea that you had to have content that was just licensed to particular regions, and go, actually, no, we're going to buy this show and give it broadcast across the world. And what we're going to do is fund that by having subscribers across the world, which was, you know, it sounds like an obvious kind of thing, but it was a completely challenging, disruptive model to the existing, you know, marketplace that is actually really quite regional.
Yeah, no, with Netflix, like I read the book. Well, I had the audiobook of how they came about, and like the journey they like went on was quite epic, to say the least, because they were looking to like send like VHS cassette tapes through the post, and it was like going, okay, yeah, that's going to cost a fortune, this, that, the other. Then they switched it to DVDs. You're like going, okay. Yeah. They were, the thing what makes me laugh with that whole story, Blockbuster, may it rest in peace, had the opportunity to buy them. And also Amazon had, like, were looking at one point to buy them, and they were like, Amazon got a little bit fluffy, and they just went off to take off over the rest of the world, leaving Netflix alone. But
but it's another great example of how, in a great idea at the wrong time, doesn't necessarily have the same traction as a great idea at the right time. And largely technology is that kind of enabler. You know, what we've seen right now, what we're doing right now with, you know, these kind of Zoom calls is only possible now because, you know, everyone's got broadband at home, and actually that broadband is reliable and it's fiber in lots of places. So, so suddenly ideas like that can succeed. And there's many ideas like that that were just too big for themselves at a different period of time where they didn't have the infrastructure around them to make it work. But with technology, allows for a much more competitive landscape in that sense. So as you say, in terms of Netflix, when they were in the DVD world, or you know, when Blockbuster were in the tape world, challenging them at that point was nearly impossible, because, you know, it was such an expensive amount of infrastructure and real estate and everything you had to have just to get going. But actually, really, when you look at it from a digital perspective, when you can distribute anything through the lines, you know, effectively for marginal extra cost, because you're just paying for the data feed, then it all becomes about whether you can get the content or not and negotiate the deals that allow you to do it, which is, you know, which is something that a lot more people can potentially, you know, have a hand in doing.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, put it this way, back in the day, going to a Blockbuster, going for that new release film, and just seeing that empty space, no disappointment anymore. Oh, no.
Yeah. No. Oh, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
How frustrating that was. But this is the thing that a lot of disruptors do. They solve problems that exist in the market that, you know, just often just there, you know, and you just go, why doesn't that work slightly better? And the problem is that big businesses are slow to innovate. They're slow to innovate. They see things, and they don't want to put the risk, you know, into that thing, because ultimately they're charged with hitting the same targets that they've been set from the year before, which didn't have that new risky thing on the, you know, on the agenda. So they never really invest in these kind of things. And then that's why, you know, smaller, different, more nimble players are able to rise. And actually, the really interesting thing about what we do in our business and what we wanted to do is we realized that a lot of the time we're generating ideas and thoughts and strategies to win for clients. And that might be about targeting different audiences or understanding different things that motivate people to be able to present things in certain ways that then make them realize that, okay, that's really interesting and you know, great. Or it might be about coming up with campaign ideas or partnership ideas or whatever it might be. But ultimately, we're good at coming up with ideas, and that might be come up with an idea that should be a product, that, you know, that actually this thing should exist. This will solve the problem. This will create the brief. And the brilliance now is with technology and having an understanding of technology, so many more things are more possible than ever before. And we want to be the kind of company that not just thinks about things like consultancies do, but also knows how to do them, which is what agencies typically were good at, you know, in terms of we know how to actually get the thing done as well. But now so many ideas are governed by technology. Like you mentioned, in terms of the whole kind of data piece, everyone talks about data. And the world is, data is becoming a real kind of currency, but this is that's old news. It's been talked about for years in terms of data is the new oil, but largely people don't really know what to do with it and how to maximize the benefit of data that they have. But what's definitely a trend is that the data that companies own themselves about their customers is becoming more of a currency for themselves, which is what first party data is all about. Because as you know, as you can see in terms of, you know, the likes of Facebook and Google, they've built their businesses ultimately off having rich data about the people that use them and allowing people to target them, to send messages to them based upon finite detail about what these people are into and how likely they are to do a certain action or a certain behavior, which is a strong, you know, has a strong currency. And big businesses have realized that, hang on a minute, we're giving our data to Facebook and then we're paying money to use and target this data, this same data. Like, that's madness.
Yeah, no, but this is the thing. The guys who are, the masters of it all is Amazon. Now, because, the company, what comes to mind when you say that about companies, like, giving them their data and then giving it away, like, if we stay away from Facebook for a moment, it's Toys R Us, because they get them everything. They opened up the gates to them, and let's just say one standing, the other one has been retired to the annals of history. And you kind of like look at it and go, oh, like, because Toys R Us had the loyal customer base around the world. It was like beloved by pretty much generation after generation. But yet they didn't use that data to like basically make the most of it, to make sure they're going to be there for the next generation, the generation after that. Yeah. Whereas Amazon was like, hey, thank you very much, with a smile.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's a number of different really good things that Amazon did. You know, one of the biggest things is they had a lot of ambition, you know, behind what they did. Mm-hmm. And they didn't just limit it to any particular, you know, field. They started quite focused, you know, on books and stuff. But that was almost like when, in the years when the internet, that's all it could cope with. But the minute they saw there was more opportunity to do more, they just kept on charging in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I think the most amazing thing about Amazon really is they were a big business that wasn't governed by short-term pursuits. So they were very tactical about everything they were doing. They would lower their prices until businesses and, you know, the competition was out of the market, and then they would increase the prices. You know, and that happened in, you know, the music industry, them selling records. You know, HMV went into administration, and then, you know, the next day Amazon put their prices up on their CDs. I remember that. They were a client at one time. So, you know, very calculated about lots of things. But the biggest thing is that, you know, they do deserve credit for is they did it all with the consumer in mind, ultimately, in terms of the reason why they drove kind of prices down and they offered the things they offered, and they offered, like, you know, free delivery and Prime and all the rest of it, is because they were quite relentless about trying to provide the very best service for consumers at whatever the cost. So they didn't make profit for a very long time. And one of the things that can't be undervalued is the letters that Jeff Bezos would always write to shareholders telling them why they're not making profit that year, and why it was, you know, still important to focus on their number one purpose behind you know, consumer first and providing the very best service for consumers, you know, all in knowledge and knowing that there will become the day when, you know, when this return will come in thick and fast, and which it has been, you know, for the last, you know, few years. But up until that point, it was, no, let's just keep on investing in the business. Let's just keep prices down, which was rare. You know, it's incredible that how rare that is nowadays to have CEOs that really challenge the market, you know, the stock market, and be like, hang on a minute, you know, we're not going to generate profits yet. You know, we're going to keep on investing. We're going to keep on investing by keeping prices low and keeping demand high. And, you know, we all think about it now as being almost like, you know, a bit just take it for granted, I guess, in terms of, you know, how difficult it was to do that at that time, and to, you know, for him not to get toppled by the shareholders and carry on, you know, delivering the dream and the promise. You know, it takes patience amongst investors to allow that kind of model to work.
Yeah, I think that's a lot. I think that's one of the number one problems I think many companies have today. They don't have the sort of patience or sort of long-term thinking to really execute a plan properly. It's like, how quickly can we get to the IPO? It's like, can we do it tomorrow? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it doesn't necessarily work out the best for themselves. And this is why I think you see a lot of companies right now with the lockdown, forthcoming recession, are in trouble. And and I think there's going to be one or two companies which are not going to be around come September, October time as things move on. But
absolutely. We're in a very difficult period where businesses have to, you know, the word pivot has been kind of overused, but it was a relevant word before, you know, we got into lockdown. And it's about, you know, diversifying what you offer and being able to be flexible and agile just to kind of, you know, act upon it. One of the things that I think is a problem is, you know, and this is also back to, you know, in terms of what we are as a company, why we call ourselves a strategic-led creative company is a very deliberate use of phrases that blends the services that we offer between consultancy and agency. And this was partially because of, you know, having worked in agencies a lot, but also having worked with consultancies and seeing what, you know, the output of consultancies were, you know, all of which are very, very good, but I think fall short in the execution of their plans and ideas. And often, you know, what would happen is, you know, big businesses will get in the consultancies who would have, you know, interesting theories to, you know, disseminate. And then it's kind of like, you know, their job is done, and then they hand it over to the client, and who then pass it on to the agency. And the things that have been talked about are not really ready for implementation. You know, the world isn't ready for that kind of, you know, graduate theory on the world. And then things fall down a little bit. But at worst yet, you know, the advice can be quite conservative because consultancies aren't very good at assessing and evaluating creativity. And creativity has a risk element to it. You know, it takes a bit of a gamble. It works off insight. You know, it's trying and longing for big emotional, big ideas that disproportionately have a disproportionate effect, where people irrationally end up buying something or responding to something and acting in a certain way. So it can never really be precisely predicted. And that's why, you know, consultancies don't really do it. They don't really understand that kind of big idea concept. So it has to be something that can be almost seen and done before. So often what you get is the advice can be either quite kind of like, you know, a bit kind of new age advice. So using phrases like agile marketing without kind of like, you know, going into, but what does that actually mean? You know, what do you actually need to do to agile marketing? You know, because yeah, it's all the word of the day, but, you know, is there any proof that agile marketing works? You know, and for me, you know, well, with terms like that, you know, they can mean a lot of different things, but for me, the word agile is relevant, but it's relevant from a perspective of your processes and how you collaborate with people to get stuff done rapidly, as opposed to just deciding to have a lot of people reacting to signals in the market, data signals, and then spending your marketing budget accordingly. Because all that happens then is you lead to knee-jerk short-term reactions on marketing spend. And that's fundamentally how a lot of marketing doesn't work, which is about brand-led persuasion that, you know, sits in the back of someone's mind and then gets triggered at a certain point of relevance for them to act. which might not be by the advertising, but it might be something completely entirely different. So I mean, and to give you a very relevant example, I mean, I used to work with, I used to have the, you know, Game and Game Station as a client, who are a brand that have gone through a lot, you know, over the years. But they were a client of mine when just after the, well, around Game Station before Game, and then they were merged together by Game. So at that point, they owned something like 60-65% of the market share, you know, complete form of dominance, which was absolutely, you know, incredible for them. But you could see the change happening quite rapidly. You know, you could see Amazon coming on board. You could see, you know, the Sainsbury's, the Tesco's of this world doing incredible deals for the likes of Call of Duty and, you know, and all those games, Battlefield, whatever else, and FIFA,
yeah,
you know, doing the deals that meant they were loss-making deals that they knew that you'd go in and buy a basket full of goods afterwards. So therefore they'll make their money on the, you know, the frozen peas or whatever. And they got advice off a consultant that basically told them that they didn't see how the gaming industry was going to be as affected as the music industry was by digitalization, because they saw it as to be more akin to the book industry, which was bizarre anyway, because you had Amazon that existed anyway, which was a bit like, well, they're doing books pretty well at the moment. But it was purely because you had Waterstones and places like that still existing, but they referenced those as being stable businesses. And this was like ridiculous. You know, to me, it was just like, this is the most short-minded thinking, you know, that I've ever kind of experienced, really, because they just weren't gamers themselves. They just couldn't imagine a world where, you know, the broadband speeds were going to be quick enough. It's like an Enron scale kind of, you know, piece of advice.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, oh yeah, you know, the internet's only big enough for X amount of websites kind of attitude. You know, it's like, well, hang on a minute. You know? Technology changes, things improve. You know, concentrate on what people want to do. Concentrate on the vision and the you know, if you could sort the technological issue out today, what would people want? And that's where you should be aiming to. That's what should be your vision. And they managed to convince the client at the time that, you know, gamers like to, you know, get the packaging and have the things on their shelves and have the cases and have the, you know, which you know, me as a gamer at the time was just like, this is the complete wrong insight. I don't know where you've got this from.
Yeah.
But it's just not correct. And actually I think that slowed them down for making the investments that they did, because what ended up happening was they invested in trying to develop their website at a pace that seemed comfortable, rather than effectively just buying one of these companies that were doing it brilliantly at the time.
Yeah.
Which would have been a short-term hit for shareholders. You know, it would have been like, oh, hang on a minute, we just invested in a big, you know, digital company, but would have sorted out the issue, and probably there'll be market leaders in that area right now today, but sadly not.
I was going to say, yeah, consultancies, like it would seem some consultancies at different periods of time make everything move so much slower, because when you went, yeah, speak to the consultants and the clients come back, come to the agency, then they basically, it's like, how many steps have the consultants taken to sort of like, this is the right options, by the time it comes back to the client and they went, okay, can you execute these options, and go, right, because the world today is blistering fast. And like, it's like one thing is on trend like one day and the next thing it's gone. And like, yeah, you can react to those short-term trends, but if you can't sort of have a big sort of long-term plan which can take in these trends and build from there, it seems a little bit hard, frustrating.
Yeah.
In some regards, if you're in one sector, like if you're on the agency side purely, because you just like got to wait and wait and wait, and by the time you do anything, the client's like, you kind of missed it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, that is it, you know, in terms of the world that we're moving into is just a much more fast-paced world than ever before. And there's this kind of thing where, you know, this back to this kind of brand disloyalty, you know, people are willing to try new brands they've never ever heard of before much more easily. And that comes also because of, you know, how technology has enabled us to feel much more confident with things that just work well. So, you know, the idea of, you know, the whole kind of fintech industry right now is quite phenomenal how quickly that's developed over, you know, the last so many years. Because we don't have to go back that many years ago where we were writing checks and people felt really uncomfortable about using internet banking. You know, they wanted a high street person to speak to and all the rest of it. And they just, you know, it was just this kind of idea of putting your money into places where you couldn't, you know, you wouldn't know whether this thing would still exist. And there was all these kind of concerns about it. And now, you know, with fingerprint technology recognition, you know, we're doing, you know, we're investing through apps where, you know, where we're doing all sorts of incredible things, you know, pensions, et cetera, without a single consideration about, oh, how long has this company, this app thing been around for, you know, and is it going to actually, you know, hold on to my money? I mean, as long as it's got FCA approval or whatever else it is, then we're away. We know we've got the protection. So our financial literacy is massively increased there, but through the technology, you know, the literacy of technology and the comfort of knowing that it's a safe environment. No one's going to steal my details while I'm making this transaction. And that has enabled a lot of things to just, you know, accelerate the way in which brands can become, solve problems, be relevant. And that means that if you're a big brand and you're not solving problems and remaining relevant, then someone else will step in and do it for you.
Yeah, no, I can see that because, yes, I remember, was it 5 years ago when I was kind of introduced by a friend to sort of banking on your mobile phone? It was just like seeing that's like, oh, okay, like before it was, yeah, online banking, you had to go to your laptop, your computer, sit down, type it in. Sometimes you had that little code reader would generate your code, then you do that. But when it was just like, yeah, in, let me, like, I remember exactly the time. Friend of mine were in John Lewis and she wanted to buy something. She had no money in her account. And it was like, oh yeah, it was declined. And she was like, ah, I haven't put any money in there. She opened up her phone. It didn't take 2 minutes. It was there, put it through again. And it was like, yep, there you go. And away, which was quite trippy to like when you first see it. But yeah, was damn extraordinary at the time watching that. But
yeah,
with that, like sort of when you were like sort of doing, I don't know if it was a recce tour of California for 44 Club Silicon Valley, like a few years back. Like, okay, it must be kind of like, I know it's only been sort of 5 years, but it must, well, not even 5 years, 4 years. But how does it feel like it's like night and day with regards to the realm of your industry?
It does and it doesn't, in a sense, because, we went in and saw some, you know, all the really innovative companies. So from everyone from Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, you know, the obvious kind of ones who were big at the time still, to new and emerging companies as well that were in the space of, you know, content production, you know, people like Maker Studios, also Tastemade, who were doing things a bit differently, but also, you know, neuro technology companies. We went to Virgin Atlantic, Galactic, sorry. Space kind of travel companies, and there were, you know, some really cutting edge things where. The thing about technology is I think that some things, you know, just appear out of nowhere and then you're like, wow, okay, that's amazing. But then some things just take a lot longer to get to a level where, you know, you thought they probably would get to. So I think voice technology is one of those things, voice recognition technology. And it's been around for a long time. You know, there's some parts of it that are great, where you go, wow, you know, so Google Translation Service, for example, you know, there's rumor that, you know, the next Apple phone is going to have that kind of automatically built in. I mean, for me, that is one of the biggest kind of like game changing things to happen in the world, where we can, you know, where I could be speaking to you, for example, right now, and let's say you were Spanish, us not to notice the difference because the translation is happening on the fly and we can just have this conversation. You know, that is a bit of a game changer. That makes the world shrink to a level that, you know, we've never seen before, which is amazing. But you know, stuff like that is not far off, but it's not really quite applied yet. And, you know, you see demonstrations of stuff like that happening. Like Google did that, you know, a few years ago on stage,
with
their translation software. Yeah, with their buds.
Yeah.
But then you don't see it come to market in the same way that's been demonstrated on the stage. So you're a bit like, hang on a minute, I'm a bit disappointed. It's a bit slow. And you know, you feel like you're waiting forever for something like that to happen. So in many ways, you know, we went and saw the cutting edge of some of the things that these people were thinking about, that some have come about, and most of them have come about, but you know, you almost then, your imagination races away and goes, oh yeah, then there'll be this, then there'll be that. And then you spend a lot, seemingly what is like a lot of time kind of waiting. And I think that that is one of the interesting things about technology. There's some remarkable things that are happening, and there's some obvious things you're just a bit like, why hasn't that happened yet? But then what happens is that just makes the ground ripe for kind of innovators. So, you know, and I'll stick on voice recognition technology just for a moment, because it's a personal recent frustration of mine where I'm a bit like, I don't understand, and it's a lockdown story more so than anything else. Which okay. is just that, you know, spend all the time with your kids in the house and all the rest of it. You know, you can't kind of like have the same kind of rules that you had before, where it's like, okay, the living room actually stays tidy, for example. It's like, you know, they're just all over it. And you find yourself on a more regular basis going, where's the remote control? And then you stop and go, I can't believe in this day and age, I have to find the remote control before turning on my TV. You know, like, why can I not say TV on, or Siri turn my TV on, or Alexa or Samsung turn my TV on? You know, why can't those few words turn on my TV? Which is just, it's just insane, isn't it? It's just ridiculous how we still have to find this remote control that always gets lost, that runs out of batteries, that all the annoying things happen about a remote control. Why do we have to do that?
You got to keep the battery companies employed. That's why.
Yeah, of course, that's it. Yeah. Anyway, so there's things like that you just go, you know, the technology is out there, but what is the barrier for it? And the barrier is, you know, you're still, the TV industry is still a market dominated by major players that needs, you know, it's hard to innovate, break in to disrupt the TV industry. It's reliant upon one of the massive companies out there, because actually the smaller players that come about, that tend to come from, you know, China or Korea or Japan, they tend to just to try and replicate what the big people are doing to some degree at a lower price point, rather than, you know, completely transform the market in that sense. And so I think that, you know, there are things like that. You know, there are in advertising and media, there are a lot of things that around how data has been used, how smartly it's been used or not. You know, programmatic has so much work to do. You know, the fact that we can track so much and we can use so much data in such a, you know, refined way, but yet we can't still analyze in the same way that we analyze a lot of traditional media, in terms of really understanding, you know, cover, reaches, frequencies, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know, really kind of blocking so we don't get, you know, into the places that we don't want to be seen in, but we also can control our exposure of our adverts throughout the web. You know, those things are all not working as well as they should do.
So even with all the like data like at our fingertips, the targeting seems to be just a little bit off somehow, or it's not being utilized as effectively as it can be.
Yeah, it's almost like there's too much choice, and there's too much kind of like, you know, there's clearly, like, let's just say when we talk about programmatic, there's clear benefits of programmatic. The benefits have been sold ahead of the capabilities to some degree. You know, there are you know, players out there that, you know, can achieve what, you know, you'd want them to achieve. But yet, the tools of which clients are using to analyze whether that is better than the other option on the table are disproportionately skewed to the wrong metrics. So, you know, the metrics that are being rewarded are the low cost metrics. I can buy a lot of stuff very cheaply. And unfortunately, because of where the, you know, the medium has emerged from, that has always been seen as the success, the you know, the metric of success. You know, how cheaply can you buy lots and lots of ads? And then that leads to ads running in all sorts of places, bad context, you know, not really necessarily being persuasive and performing, but it giving a massive number on a spreadsheet. So everyone feels like they're doing the right thing, which is completely wrong, you know. And actually, it's far better using a handful of sites that are well-read, high attention, you know, highly engaged, and spending a lot more money with a fewer, you know, suppliers, which is what you would have done in the good old days when you're trading any kind of media. But because there's an ability to reach everyone around the world very, very quickly, very, very easily, and reach every site in the world, people are seeing that as their biggest advantage and the necessity rather than, you know, an optional thing and only use when necessary.
Yeah, so just basically reliance on the quantity, like let's forget about the quality of each person coming through. And like, this is a thing. I would say if you look at sort of more like sort of high, like if I look at in the world of sort of high-end fashion, people look at the high quality brands and go, right, oh, Gucci, Prada, this, yeah, that, the other, and like go, right, they don't have everyone buying from them, but they do sell everything at a very high premium. And yeah, if you paid a little bit more on your ads for that quality, you might have a customer which could turn into 4 or 5 or a lifetime of returns.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Interesting. Liking it. Yeah. Liking it. when you first started, like many moons ago, back at MediaCom, like what was the sort of world of, like, what was it like back then when you sort of came out of university and went, yes, here I am, welcome to the world? How was that compared to now?
You know, it's definitely very different, but it's hard to, you know, talk through the experience of a graduate coming out of university right now, what they might be faced with. Mm. You know, whenever you are in whatever position, I think you always historically look at the positions before you and go, oh, it was better then. It was better then. You know, I went to university and they stopped paying kind of the grants, and it was like, you know, they introduced student loans. And it was like, oh God, you know, student loans, and you come out and you've got a debt and you think you're never going to pay it off. And, you know, that's a massive worry. And then you look at the situation now and you're like, you see the fees they're paying now and the debts they get themselves into now. And you go, wow, you know, that is a whole nother level of concern and anxiety attached to, you know, what you do next. So in many ways, you know, coming out, there was obviously a pressure to kind of, you know, get a job and do things. Mm. That pressure now is on a whole different scale for people. But I to some degree had the freedom at least of deciding to pursue what I wanted to do rather than, let's say, what I was qualified to do. You know, I did economics and philosophy at university. You know, most people who do that would go into maybe accountancy or something kind of management related in that sense. You know, so there were obvious kind of choices in that regard. But for me, my journey was, you know, I wanted to get into marketing. Mm. And I wanted to get something that allowed a bit more kind of creativity in what I did. So I tried to get on some graduate recruitment schemes, first of all. And, you know, I started at the one that was paying the most, which was Mars. So that was always attractive. And I did quite well at it in that I got down to the last, you know, whatever, 25 or so people. So, yeah, you know, I went to the, you know, the, almost like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory experience of, you know, oh yeah, and here's the factory, and, you know, wandering around with the final crew. And it was one of those where, you know, every year a graduate recruitment scheme has an option of, you know, recruiting. It might be 5 people, it might be 15, it might be 20. Mm. So, you know, you never really know what number they're going to end up being final selection. So all I know is that I didn't get it, and I missed out, but I was one of a number of people that missed out in the final selection. Yeah. So from that, you know, you realize that it's quite an exhaustive kind of experience going through a graduate recruitment program. You know, it takes a number of weeks and, you know, turning up to places in Slough and all sorts. And so I kind of like decided that, okay, I wasn't just going to just keep on applying to these. What I was going to do is try and get into the agency world. And so I looked at, you know, all the famous kind of agency names that, you know, you think of and you knew of at the time. So the Saatchis and the JWTs of this world. And I applied to all of them and got rejected from absolutely all of them. Not even an interview. And this was in a day that you had to put a photo on your application to some advertisers would ask you to put a photo on your application form.
Okay.
So even then, I was there like, yeah, that was a little bit wrong.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, I didn't you know, follow up on many and kind of like, you know, ask the questions why and all the rest of it. You know, all the letters were pretty much kind of like, you know, standard kind of rejection letters.
Yeah.
But I do remember calling up one that, you know, I took a particular interest in, who did make me put my photo on the application form. And I wanted just to know, okay, you know, why, you know, and I knew full well they probably had a pile of CVs. They didn't even know who I was or whatever else, that kind of thing. I just wanted to know the reasons why they asked for such level of detail, you know, why appearance was so important. You know, the passport photo was so important behind the job application. And anyway, and they basically, you know, it was as you can imagine, it was a bit of an awkward phone call. But at least it wasn't a Zoom call. You know?
why?
But it was an awkward phone call where the best kind of defense that they had about why, you know, I didn't progress or whatever else was, they said, oh, look, we get all sorts of people from, you know, Oxford and Cambridge applying, and, you know, and it's just such a high standard, and, you know, that's all we kind of accept. And that's one thing that's remained consistent, I think, in my years of working, you know, in advertising and being closer towards the advertising agency side, where I realized that that kind of Oxbridge kind of thing is a very real thing that actually a lot of kind of traditional advertising agencies prided themselves on being a recruiting ground for, because they almost wanted to position themselves as having more intelligent people than the next office. Mm. So we only get people from Oxford and Cambridge or whatever else, you know. And actually, it's amazing, really, because one of the things that's occurred to me in all these years of working in the industry is that people have, particularly on the creative side, have very particular views about who does certain roles. You know, what an account person's like, what a strategic person's like, what a creative's like. And you know, you just got people that are very much the same doing those similar kind of jobs. And that's what they wanted. They wanted the people that are facing the client to be, you know, as smart as they could possibly be, mm-hmm. and to have no questions about their background, about whether they're clever enough or not. But they didn't want them to be creative. They didn't want them to come up with ideas. They didn't want them to be strategic. They just wanted them to serve as the client, you know? How dare you step out that box and do something else, you know? And for me, this was ridiculous anyway. So, you know, I definitely wasn't qualified for the account manager role, because I had creativity with, you know, I wanted to be creative. I wanted to come up with ideas. I wanted to problem solve. And that's what I thought agencies did. But it occurred to me at the time that it was like, well, actually, you just want people to come in and, you know, be intelligent, nice, and not come up with ideas, which I found very bizarre. But anyway, luckily enough, you know, I didn't give up there. And I looked at, you know, the IPA website, and I noticed they had jobs advertised in the IPA website. And then when I looked on the jobs that were advertised, there were all these jobs from companies that I didn't understand, you know, didn't know who they were or what they were. They all sounded like pharmaceutical companies, you know, like OMD and you know, and Starcom or whatever, and, you know, Mediacom.
Yeah.
So really kind of like weird names. But when I read the job description, they were all really quite interesting. And actually, I applied to three different companies for three different jobs. That, you know, one was a TV buyer, one was a press buyer, one was a planner. Mm. I definitely liked the planner job better, but I ended up choosing the press buyer job from Mediacom because, well, before I say that, actually, the difference was I got three interviews for a start straight away.
Nice.
Secondly, I got three jobs offers at the same time from those interviews, which was also nice. So suddenly I was in this, like, you know, overnight, I was in this situation where the whole ad industry rejected me, but yet this weird kind of unknown part of the industry accepted me. So I was like, brilliant. So I went and I started working at Mediacom. You know, one of the things that was apparent at Mediacom was, you know, ultimately I bought into the people more than the organization at the time. Mm. And those people were definitely a more diverse bunch of people. You know, my first kind of manager or team head was a guy called Sanjay Shabby, you know, so, you know, no prizes for guessing where he's from, but, you know, it was, it was like, you know, it was really kind of like, you know, interesting mix of people. People like Karen Blackett were, you know, part of the leadership team, etc.
Yeah.
So I went there and, started my career there, started working up in press buying, did that for a year, you know, really enjoyed it, but I always looked into the company and had a view of what job did I really want to be doing within the company. Because bear in mind, I was new into media, didn't really know what everyone was doing their job. So, you know, throughout your first kind of like 6 months, you're very observant as to what is everyone doing and would I rather be doing that job than the job that I'm actually currently doing. And that was the case. So I managed to transfer internally to planning, did planning for a couple more years. But again, I wanted to move into strategy because I was suddenly like, right, strategy is where I really want to go. Mm-hmm. But you know, being a massive organization with only a few people in a, you know, in an ivory tower doing strategy, it was like get in line basically. So I realized that the only way that I could kind of transition into strategy was by leaving to get a strategic job at a strategic agency, which was Michael Eadies and Bednash. Mm-hmm. So went to Michael Eadies and Bednash, worked there for a couple of years, predominantly on Channel 4, you know, helped to do things like launch More 4, but also bring Film 4 back to free to air as well, because it was a paid for subscription channel before that.
Yeah.
If you can rack your brain back to that.
Yeah, it was, but I think, didn't it show TV commercials for the paid subscription as well?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
That's what I didn't sign up to. I was like, so you are going to put a TV commercial in the middle of my film several times. I was like, no. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it, isn't it? In many ways, they were the Netflix, but because they just had this kind of, you know, whatever, old school kind of like, you know, baggage.
Yeah.
That meant, oh, you have to, you know, people want adverts. You know, you've got to put adverts in the content. That's what people want, you know.
No, it's like,
just do about the adverts. Yeah. Just take my money and do about the adverts. Done. Yeah. Yeah. Really, really interesting, actually, that that at the point of which Film 4 went free to air, the decision was to keep the adverts but take away the subscription money rather than get rid of the adverts and keep the subscription money, which is what Netflix did. But anyway.
Oh God!
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. That's painful.
It all seemed very logical at the time, in the world at the time. You know, the internet wasn't so strong then, so I guess it was hard to distribute.
As you say it, you're like, I wasn't convinced.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So I worked at, you know, I got my strategic title, let's say, and my strategic belt by going to Michael Eadies and Bednash.
Yeah.
And after, you know, a couple of years, I've been thrown into lots of things there. The decision, I went to PhD Rocket with a thought of probably it being my last agency I ever worked at, actually, really, because, you know, I'd worked at agencies of different sizes. And by then I was a bit like, okay, you know, if this doesn't give kind of like, you know, the complete career happiness, then maybe there's a different kind of side of the industry I should be going into. Mm. And I worked at, you know, there for 4.5 years, which was, you know, great, you know, lots of great brands, did stuff like, you know, UK TV kind of, you know, relaunched the rebranding of all the channels and all the rest of it, like Dave, et cetera.
Yeah.
Among lots of other things, you know, helping to take things like Global Radio or Capital Radio nationally and all that kind of stuff, you know. So a lot of great things. I got headhunted and persuaded to go to the Seven Stars, which was, you know, definitely an up-and-coming independent media agency in a world where I had been selling the idea of bigger was better, or certainly having a blend of, you know, big and small in terms of, you know, being backed by a big network was really important. You know, size mattered. You know, everywhere I'd been at before were, you know, those were the selling points, going, you know, we're bigger, we've got more of this, we've got more of that. But Seven Stars were doing well. And, you know, when I met the Seven Stars, they convinced me, because they were ultimately, you know, a buyers from background who were doing very well at the buying side of media, and they needed strategic kind of input. And that was like, you know, against the model that I thought could exist in the world. It was like, hang on a minute, you know, aren't you supposed to struggle to buy if you're small and independent?
Yeah.
But for very logical reasons, they were outdoing the competition. And that is, you know, is still prevalent today in that, you know, one size and big kind of group deals, etc., were no longer being an advantage to every client within the group.
Yeah.
They were advantages to certain clients, the biggest clients in the group, but not necessarily the smaller clients in the group. And small was becoming much, much bigger. As big, you know, big agencies became much more group-based, much more globally based. But the size of big clients became absolutely huge. And they were totally dominant in that agency compared to, you know, what everyone would typically consider to be a big client, let's say spending 5 to 20 million pounds. But suddenly that was a relatively small client by most of the groups, you know, most of the big agencies.
Okay, yeah. Like money is money, in my opinion.
Yeah, money is money, exactly. Yeah, so, yeah. So what that would happen, what happened as a result of that is that, you know, that they'll get a, you know, an inferior service in all senses of the word, basically, because they just didn't have the, you know, the teams and the numbers and the quantities to service the clients that were just on part of their long tail. But also, you know, what the Seven Stars were doing were they were trading properly as well. They weren't just doing deals and forgetting about, you know, doing deals in the year ahead for the group and then going, all right, okay, now let's just force clients to spend in a certain way. It was like, actually, you know, we will, you know, negotiate on your behalf and get you the best deal that's bespoke and right for you. So anyway, that's why the buy-in thing worked. And I was hired to help develop the strategic product, which was great. And in a very short period of time, you know, we did very, very well in terms of, not only did we grow from a media perspective, but we also grew from a culture perspective and set lots of kind of like records and standards there. So for 5 years in a row, we were listed in the Sunday Times top 100 small best companies to work for, but not just listed. For 4 years, we got top five positions.
Nice.
Which was incredible. So you know, things like that were really interesting insights into the business. You know, when I came to Seven Stars, it was something that the, you know, previous companies had always taken very seriously. You know, PhD had taken it seriously, Mediacom had taken it seriously, and for me, I had been, you know, persuaded by them as to the value of it, because it was one of the things that I could tell, you know, my mum, as to, oh yeah, you know, I work at a place that's listed in the Sunday Times, you know, top 100 companies, a proper company, because otherwise she didn't understand what media was. So it gave us a certain sense of pride behind working in the industry for that company, but also, which helped it attract talent, but also it helped with clients, actually. It helped, you know, to tell clients that, you know, these were part of your values, but people were part of your values. Mm. And you realized that that was really important. You invested in people. And therefore, you know, we had a lot of clients that were also trying to get on that journey, or, you know, were part of that. You know, maybe they were, you know, one of the bigger companies, best companies to work with. And they would end up being like, right, you know, cool, you've got to tell us more about how we can do better on this list. You know, they suddenly, there was the common bond, which was great. So that was a great insight into, you know, what makes a business that's based on people really work, which was about, you know, giving people responsibility, taking away hierarchies, creating great places to work, and allowing you know, the profit to take care of itself in that sense, not undervaluing the product. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I got persuaded to become managing director of Media Hub within Mullen Lowe, which was by a CEO that I knew, who only unfortunately was there for 10 months while I was there. So a large part of me joining was to get the experience to do what I'm doing now, which is working for myself. You know, I wanted to work in full service completely, you know, because I believe that, you know, the full service had a right to work. He very much kind of sold the vision that he had in mind of, you know, making it work, building something up, you know, doing what I'd helped to do at the Seven Stars, but within there and living that kind of dream. So, you know, that happened for a couple of years, but you know, with changes of, you know, he left and all the rest of it, and suddenly it was like, actually, hang on a minute, you know, I haven't got this kind of like, you know, partner in hand with this same vision anymore. But I realized that the market was changing, and actually the real advantage and benefit was to have a different model that was suited to market, that was much more communications and problem solving led than it necessarily being media or creative led. So, and that's what led to, informed me and led to the direction of creating a barbershop.
Oh my. So, you step out into the world, like, fresh face, new, with a look like a hand, like years of experience under the belt, and yeah, you're now out there doing it. It must be kind of, how does that feel?
It feels really good. It feels really, really good. I mean, you know, you can answer that question on a number of different levels, because, you know, the amount that's changed in the last 3 or 4 months has been, you know, disproportionate to the amount that's changed before that. So, you know, or even in the years preceding that. But, you know, let's face it, we've been in a period of, you know, tremendous change. You know, it seems like Brexit was, and all the discussion around Brexit was a very, very long time ago. It seems like it was a lifetime away.
Yeah, I agree, totally.
which is it's insane to think of it like that. But so much has changed recently, and actually, when I think of, you know, we launched, I created the business, nearly or just over a year ago, but was in stealth mode. What I described to be stealth mode for a little while, and then officially came out with the, you know, the revealing of the name and everything around November last year. So when you look at that, it's like, okay, well, actually, you know, very little time has kind of gone by. But really, what is great about it is that, you know, we managed to connect with, you know, some really great purpose-led brands that have stayed with us as clients since the start. You know, when we got them, some of them during stealth mode. Which has helped us throughout this kind of COVID period, because, you know, we work with clients on a retained basis. That means, you know, we're not governed by how much money they spend. You know, we're not incentivized by how much money they spend or they don't spend. We just want to kind of do the right thing, solve the right problems, and give over our time and expertise to creating better communications for them, but also better businesses for them. And actually, when you work with clients that are purpose-led and have their values in the right place, then actually guiding you through these COVID Black Lives Matter kind of times, there's a lot more direction and sense of purpose about what they're doing and what they exist for. So some of the thoughts and ideas and recommendations just become much more easily to accept, in a sense, and to move forward on. So you can contribute a lot more in that sense. Mm-hmm. And that was a conscious decision, actually, to work with people that, people that we just kind of, like, you know, knew would enjoy working with, that were out to do the right thing, and that weren't making the world a better place, basically. Which when you're working for yourself as well, it's much more rewarding. So, you know, longer days, longer hours, but much more rewarding with it. And actually, one of the really brilliant things about how we're set up to work, and, you know, and the way we work, you know, we can work with anyone. Mm. You know, if we see brilliant people here or there or whatever else, we've got no issue with working with them, connecting with them, bringing them in, involved in projects, or recommend them to clients, which is great. So we can arrive at solutions quicker with greater expertise. But also, we can also set about to develop products ourselves if we feel like, okay, actually, that's something that we feel like, well, you know, correct a problem in the market. Let's just do it. You know, let's just do it and then put our, you know, our whatever into action, where our, you know, the words and our ideas kind of like are, you know, it's a bit of a money where our mouth is kind of, you know, proposition. But actually, why not? You know, and actually to date, you know, the things that we've done that are, you know, not for profit, you know, we haven't done them necessarily just to make a killing out of it, because, you know, we're not here thinking, okay, we want to just create another business. We want to do the business that we're doing. Mm. But actually, if we can create things that are idea-based, things that can galvanize people, that can be successful and solve problems, then great. It's like a gift to, you know, a part of the world to solve something. And last week, you know, I launched diversespeakers.uk, which is a good example of that.
What is this? Diverse Speakers. Please tell me more.
So Diverse Speakers was basically a reaction to the common problem, which has presented itself more so in lockdown times, as we spend more time behind a screen, logging into webinars and whatever else, to try and correct the balance of, you know, unequal representation on stage, basically, you know, in terms of speakers at events. And it came out of the fact that, you know, generally, you know, myself and lots of others who have been more vocal about it would campaign quite a lot when they would turn up to an event and they would see what can only be described as, well, the nickname is manals, but, you know, is male only panels, basically white male panels only panels.
Let's say the whole 44 when I was watching it, the 44 club, yes. There was you sitting in the middle and there was a lady sitting on your left, like two people away. Yeah, it was just like, yeah.
Rest. Yeah. Stand out.
Yeah.
Yeah, stand out. And that's exactly it. And it's like, you know, and it happens far too often. And it's in this day and age, it's just like, why? And what happens is, you know that event organizers, they're busy, they're rushing away. Mm. They might not necessarily have a complete kind of full landscape understanding of, you know, who's around. But ultimately, it's never been an issue that's been front of mind to them. And it's only until people start to go, hang on a minute, you know, that's just wrong. Because this is it. You know, the stage is more symbolic than you might think about, you know, what the purpose of a diverse and, you know, an equal stage. You know, when we do work and think about how can we improve representation in our industry and opportunity of our industry, diversity and inclusion, you know, a big part that people often forget is about having role models, you know, so people that people can aspire to. You know, the most intelligent people in the UK are choosing other professions, you know, diverse people, other professions other than advertising and media, because they see their chance of progression as being higher in those other professions. They see qualification-backed professions where they can get that, you know, qualification. Therefore, they can walk into that environment and hold their own and not be, you know, pegged back as being a better option than going into, you know, advertising or media where there's an element of, well, how well do you get on with your boss, you know, kind of attitude. Mm. Or just in terms of, you know, hoping that the doors get opened for you. And actually what you need is you need role models that look diverse, that look like them, sit on the top of organizations so they can go, okay, well, there is a path through. Because, you know, everyone needs a bit of a, you know, a path through to some degree. They need to know there's no doors aren't going to get shut in their face when they get to certain levels. And actually every single person, even white male CEO, have had people that have endorsed them, backed them, given them those opportunities, those briefs, seen them as little kind of like, you know, little sons in the company or whatever else, reflections of their own kind of self, and help them along. And that's what you need to get to the top. And actually, if you don't have people that look like you, then your chances of having that are far, far less. So, you know, a lot of people make the decision to not bother, you know, with the struggle of it. But when bringing it back to the stages, you know, when it's about diverse speakers, is when you go to an event and they're talking about the future of advertising or the future of media or whatever else it is, forward thinking things, you know, you need the representation at that event. You need to be able to tell people that the future is going to look a little bit different from the stale future of the past, the stale and bland future of the past. And ultimately, at the heart of it, it's about, we're working in a creative industry where creativity is the ingredients of experiences, you know, random connections, being able to, you know, deal with challenging thoughts and concepts and ultimately understand cultures and people and connection.
Mm. Yeah, no, I put it this way. I do like the whole concept of diverse speakers because, like, the whole thing is, yeah, as you say, being in, like, seeing for the future, it's about right now being involved in the conversation. If you're not involved in the conversation or see to be, well, can be perceived in being involved in conversation, like there's going to be important things which will be missed, important opportunities which will be withheld from many a person. And like, this is the thing, withholding those opportunities is the main reason why there isn't any growth or diversity amongst, like, yeah, people of color, ladies who might be wanting to come up there as well. And it will remain the status quo. And like finding when I hear you say diverse speakers, the immediate thing what comes to my mind is the people who've actually made the paths through on those particular industries. And the whole thing is, it's sometimes very hard to find the pathfinder, not unless if they are someone who's become very big and very influential. It's like, like someone who's like going, yeah, I was a like VP in this like company over here doing advertising or like doing media buying, isn't going to really sort of be like, yes, this VP. No, it doesn't happen like that. You're not going to get them on TV or anything like this. But if they are talking on stage, if they are talking on, say, more blogs, podcasts, other forms of media, getting their name out there, it's just an extra avenue for people to find them And when they can find them, they can then take it forward and go, right, this is how I did that. And you never know, they might be able to approach this person and go, yeah, can you, like, can you give me any help or an idea? And then, like, they might go, no, but if you talk to this group over here, this, they'll be able to set you straight. So it's just more opportunities, find more pathfinders, talk more, get the word out. I'm liking it. I really am.
Totally. You can't underestimate the value of, you know, good advice and information. You know, most people in our industry have had it through getting in, through knowing a family relative that has gone, oh, speak to, you know, Bob. They'll you know, they'll tell you about the industry or whatever, or, you know, that inevitably leads to, oh, there's a work experience opportunity in this company, or, you know, or someone in this department's doing something, and then doors open. You know, doors open with the, you know, with the intelligent kind of guidance as to, you know, what is needed to succeed in that environment, and, you know, that those words get said, which are great, you know, which everybody needs. But you've got to appreciate the fact that when you're getting people who haven't had a legacy, you know, of history in an industry, then they're not going to have those same, you know, those same words of wisdom readily available to help them through it.
Yeah. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but with regards to the sort of media advertising world, it's like, it seemed to go through a period of time where it was like unpaid interns, if you get what I mean. You do your internship, and generally that just like cuts out a huge sway of the population, like from one part of the country all the way down to the other. So it's like, yeah, the only people what get into the unpaid interns are basically with families which can actually economically support them. So it's just like, you've got this sort of realm of nepotism going, like, feeding into the system, which I don't think is good for any sort of, like, organized, well, any type of industry, if it's just going to be the same type of people. Where's the originality or the flair of brilliance going to come from?
Absolutely. You know, the thing about the industry is advertising has been potentially, you could say at worst, it's been quite shallow the way it's operated a lot in the past. You know, being seen as its purpose and its value just to kind of make things better and sell things and sell products and do so and not really worry about the consequences of it. And in that, it just extends throughout the whole of everything, you know, in terms of, you know, offering unpaid internships because we've got a queue of people that are waiting to get that job kind of thing, you know, and having that kind of like arrogance about approach, which not feeling a sense of responsibility to the world in how, you know, you make things fair, but also a sense of responsibility in the fact that, you know, your adverts communicate a certain thing that influence people and persuade people to be a certain way. So therefore, you know, you've got to try and reflect some good and some right and some balance in those things that you portray. So if you're writing scripts, if you're writing adverts, if you're casting adverts, you know, they should be reflective of how you want society to be, rather than just painting a picture of how it is, how it was yesterday, or how it is because that's the way your office is made up and that's the bubble you're basically living in. And it feels right because, you know, you're all from the same place. And I think that, you know, the whole thing about, you know, unpaid internships is a very obvious thing why you should never do them. You know, it's basic kind of like, again, you know, basic ethics. But, you know, I think a lot of people, it wouldn't even occur to them as being an issue because, you know, this world of just, oh, you know, just thinking about profit or thinking about short-term gains just allows people to just not even bother giving it 1 ounce of thought. They look at, you know, junior members of the team. You know, I spoke at a panel the other day and I criticized how the word junior even exists in job titles in the industry. You know, like how condescending for a graduate to come out and be called a junior, you know, junior, you know, account manager or junior copywriter or junior creative. It's just like awful.
Well, but like, this is the thing, like if they end up having to talk to a client or have to like get in contact with a client and they have to put that on, like basically on the signature of their email or like, yeah, just basically any sort of contact with them, like the client's reaction is going to be like going, you know, I shouldn't really be talking to you because you can't help me. But yeah. They might be the person who might be able to go, yeah, if you did this or that.
Totally. And the really dumb thing about businesses that swear by doing that, which is what they do, is they're artificially creating hierarchies that don't need to be there. Because that person can definitely perform higher than the expectations of a junior, what a client thinks that a junior can achieve. Now, what you're basically saying is, well, I don't know anything well enough to really make a decision on this. So why are you on the phone to me? Why are you, on my business? Why are you trying to solve this problem? Like, go away, work those things out, and then come back when you can. It totally disrespects the person's intelligence.
Yeah.
Recruit intelligent people and make them do, jobs that are way below their pay grade. And the problem is with people who have businesses like that is they don't realize that they make them less efficient, because what ends up happening is the client demands to speak to the person that's more senior. And, everything goes through this chain that clogs up the system, where there have to be lots of people that have to prove something rather than someone that's intelligent enough to do, a largely insignificant task, just gets on and does it and tells the client they've done it and has that relationship.
Yeah, no, like also when you're saying like you're a junior, you're not really encouraging them to take any form of responsibility greater than their role. So all you're just doing is stunting their growth overall. So it's just...
it's ridiculous. But unpaid internships, you'll be horrified to know that there are agencies that still do them. And and it's just like, how do you still believe that that is the way of getting the best people? But also that's fair by any stretch of the imagination, any measure. It's not like you're paying them a lot of money.
Yeah.
You're basically paying a minimum wage, to make it a paid position. It's ridiculous.
crazy world. I'm just very surprised people just go back into that type of system, get churned up again and again and again. So with the diverse voices, is it just going to be purely getting people on stage, or is it going to be a case of getting them on other media as well?
It totally is other media as well. I mean, we've already had requests for podcasts and book clubs and things like that, and absolutely, it's been built to really facilitate and make it easy for event organizers, but also allow more diverse voices just to have get access, get themselves out there, because often there's we also know there's a lot of people that are great people that sit in organizations that ultimately rely upon the organization to filter through opportunities to them. Rather than being a direct point of contact. So we're set up to, smash down those barriers, let talent shine. And, it's a non-for-profit thing. So, we ask for tips off the people that have got budgets to book things to just keep the service going. So, we can automate as much as possible. But the ambition is just to, make it a thing of the past, make this whole all white male panel talking about this again, just the thing of the past. It just doesn't need to be a discussion anymore.
Yeah, at this moment in time, I know people are doing sort of seminars and conferences now purely through Zoom. It should be very easy to get people onto the panels regardless. When we do get out of lockdown and basically back onto the whole conference scene and everything like this, I still don't see how it would be a problem getting other people in for those. Like, it's just a case of when they open up venues. But,
And there's another thing, sorry, I should mention about diverse speakers, is that we're also here to make sure that that the diversity gets a fair price for its input as well. So the events that are paying speakers, again, it's always a bit of a mystery to the less informed about, should they be charging? How much should they be charging? How much is it worth?
Yeah.
And, and a very simple thing that we do is, we ask the event organizer whether they're paying their speakers. And if they ask paying any speakers, then we expect them to pay our speakers. And we will tell the speakers that they should ask for a fee, the fee that they charge. And we will tell them that if they don't want to ask for a fee, or they don't need the fee, that we would expect a donation to charity. So, our particular choice is Brixton Finishing School. So, you know, we're still trying to, you know, keep the value in the thing, you know, in the thing that it is. Don't undervalue the art of speaking and turning up and having, you know, expertise on a platform. Pay what it deserves, you know, because we don't want it to be seen as some kind of, you know, cheap way of getting talent.
Indeed, indeed. I'm liking that. I'm liking that a lot, sir. Yeah. Now, like one of the things which I was quite shocked to see about you is, I don't know how I can put this without possibly offending. You got a little bit of, how can I say, a fighting streak in you.
This isn't about my 100% winning record in the boxing ring, is it?
Well, you tell me, sir, dressed up in red, looking quite aggressive.
It was all in the name of charity.
So how did you get involved in, like, did they just like come up to you and, hey, you know, we want you to come fight for our charity? Last person standing wins the prize money. We don't talk about the dead.
Well, it's a little bit like that, but so the media industry used to have a big fundraising boxing night that NABS, the organization that a bit like the charity support, you know, organization for the industry, used to do. And, you know, it used to be a big fundraising event. I actually never went to it. You know, I was never invited. But it was apparently great. And it raised a lot of money. But then it became kind of out of favor, you know, because of various reasons, and it came out of fashion and it stopped. And actually, you know, X amount of years went by. And John Maloney, who works in the industry, has always been involved in you know, in the boxing kind of world for himself, you know, his family and everyone. And his wife is an event organizer as well. So if, a number of years back, they decided to basically recreate this event. And they recreated the event with much more class than ever before. And it's just become like one of the best kind of nights, you know, in the year, but a huge fundraiser at the same time. So, you know, I had a couple of people, like one of my ex-bosses, you know, Mark Jarvis, he fought in it 1 year. And you always know people that do it. And every year, you know, you go there and you're like cheering them along. And everyone's like, yeah, I'll do it next year. You know, kind of talking all kind of big and brave. And then the next day you're like, absolutely no way. Like, you know, no way will I do it again.
Sober heads return.
Yeah, that's it. And actually what happened this time around that was different was the year before I did it, I was approached by, you know, someone that used to work with me, who also works with John, was like, oh yeah, John's looking for more agency people because he got a lot of sales side, but not enough agency people to take the part. So
I wonder why.
And anyway, this person used to work for me, he knows that I'm competitive just in terms of a sporting sense, but I've never done boxing before. So it was quite a big ask, and I was like, at the time I was like, absolutely no way. And then actually what happened was really, there were a couple of events that, you know, made it happen. One is slightly unfortunate and tragic, is that a good friend who also lives where I live in terms of in Tunbridge Wells, and was also a bit of a media kind of legend, so lots of people knew him, a guy called Fazal Jamal. He actually was training for it a year before, and actually died from a heart attack in the process of doing it. Yeah, so really sad and tragic, you know. But you know, great character. We've done lots of fundraising things for him since, which is great. But you know, it was a moment of like, okay, wow, that's pretty bad and that's pretty sad. So I wanted to do something that could also potentially get the support of the people that knew him behind it, mm-hmm. to, you know, to help fund. His wife was also raising some money for the local school, so it's like, okay, this might be a way of also doing something that helps that cause. Anyway, and that combined with the fact that as I set about to do my own thing, I suddenly realized that the timing was perfect, where I suddenly wouldn't have the routine that meant that, you know, I would struggle to make some of the early morning and late night training sessions. You know, living in Tunbridge Wells and having to get into London for a 7:30 a.m. or 7 o'clock even, 7 o'clock. Training session in Vauxhall is quite a challenge. So you know, it's such a commitment for training that it requires that you have to be in. You have to be kind of like, you know, you can't just be, yeah, I'll do it for a bit and see how it goes. But having said that, I did kind of like start going, yeah, I'll do it and see how it goes. You know, going with the training and see how it goes. And actually, yeah. You know, I had a lot of people that have done it before who were, you know, really supportive, you know, who would like, you know, turn up for training and give advice and all the rest of it. And actually you get into it quite a lot. You know, some people, you know, straight away, they kind of like go, love the training. But then as soon as you get in the ring and start sparring, go, oh no, this is not for me. You know, I wouldn't say that I liked getting hit in the face. I said I very much didn't like getting hit in the face. But what I realized very quickly, very early on, is the art of the whole game was to try and not get hit. It was more about not getting hit than it was about hitting the other person. That was the way to win a boxing match. So I used some strategic mind to kind of like work out a way to win. And actually, ever since that point, you know, I was training on fitness and defense and doing the drills, but you know, a lot of people were training to knock the other guy out or the other woman out. And I was like, that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen in these fights, you know? And actually, you know, 9 times out of 10, when you see people going that at you, they burn themselves out, because no matter how fit they are, they exhaust themselves by trying to, you know, do that, but also the adrenaline of the night and all the rest of it. And I've watched it time and time again, we saw that. So I was just like, right, it's a strategic fitness thing of not getting hit and winning by points. So that's the thing that carried me through, basically, and allowed me to win, which was great.
Ah, excellent. Champion extraordinaire. Loving it. Loving it big time. Oh, no. Well, you know what? On that joyful note. Yeah. So, what would you say might be one of the next sort of big moves for the industry, do you think? Like, can you see on the horizon, or is it still a little bit of a mystery?
Well, in terms of the industry as a whole, in terms of where it's going, in the direction?
Or what? Yeah, industry as a whole, in the direction it's going, because there's a lot of change afoot.
Yeah, it's... I think that actually, you know, if you'd asked me a few months ago, you would have said, yeah, it is a bit of a mystery. There's lots of different things going on. There's all this kind of data challenges, privacy issues, potential regulation at bay. All these things were, you know, even Brexit, for example, were factors that were going to affect things. But I think that, you know, there are a few things that have happened. You know, COVID has meant more clients are, you know, trying to get more control over their media spends. So, you know, try and really understand what they can do themselves to save money, to get better understanding and be more flexible in that sense. So I think the kind of the trend of in-housing is just going to accelerate a little bit in certain parts of media. I still think that, you know, agencies have a lot to offer clients, because that kind of outside of their own bubble thinking, their clients' bubbles, is what agencies are brilliant at. You know, getting kind of like, you know, different minds, different experiences together to collaborate, people working on different products and different things to actually apply them to their client's problem is a really strong, unique asset that you need from an agency. And but I think one of the biggest things that are going to happen is there's two things that relate to each other, and it's driven by the conscious consumer, which is a thing that's happening regardless of agencies, about consumers having more concern about the products they're buying, and not just the products they're buying from a, you know, environmental level, but the ethics level of the company that they're buying from as well. With infinite choice and so much, you know, limitless choice, it's like actually they are now going, hang on a minute, I don't have to spend my money that way. And that has been impacted more by the transition of COVID that stopped us spending anything with anyone for a period of time, made us go, okay, hang on a minute, what do we need to back in our lives? What are we going to, what's going to earn our pound? You know, where are we going to put that money? And, you know, and I realized that, you know, in some areas, you know, you're still forced to use and spend and provide in certain avenues because you haven't got enough choice. But actually, in a lot of places where people have got choice, I think they are making those choices, and they will continue to make those choices. Mm-hmm. And advertising will respond to that. And what has been one of the beautiful things about the timing of the Black Lives Matter movement, it's come off the back of COVID, where we're sitting down in lockdown considering these things and, you know, and concerns about the way the world works, but also with a view that, you know, the new world that we construct can look a little bit differently from the old world. And actually, I think that, you know, advertising and the idea of brands with purpose has been a term that a lot of people have kind of like, you know, thought about, debated about whether it really matters or not, whether it really does drive profit or whether it's just a bit of a fluffy word. And actually, some brands have been doing purpose without really doing purpose, you know, making sure that everything is in order. And you saw it with Black Lives Matter. It was a symbol of the fact that, you know, how they showed support for a cause, but without the depth behind it, and the depth and commitment, you know, the board weren't diverse, the company didn't have a history of diversity, but yet they were trying to claim the credit for being, you know, with the cause.
Yeah.
Which is, terrible.
Yeah, and I put it this way, like, I was watching this thing. It had, founder of like Facebook,
Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, Mark Zuckerberg. He was up in front of Congress, like this congresswoman, and like, yeah, oh. I like, you know what? Like, if I saw a child getting beat like that, I would be like, no, stop. They've had enough. They understand. They learn. Like, she was like going through, what's about diversity on the board, this, that, the other, like going through this. And like the reason why it sort of highlighted it most in me, because when you look at companies like Facebook or like sort of many of the big Silicon Valley sort of companies, they're all about, yes, diversity, and yes, like we want to be all inclusive. But when it comes down to the actual doing, it is a little bit more not really being practically done. And so when like it's highlighted that you're kind of like, okay, come on, what's going on here? Like, you know, and yeah, she took him to task for quite a bit of time, and it looked like he didn't have any answers whatsoever.
Well, that is the new world that we're in. And this is where advertising has to fit into it. You know, you can't just claim certain things without expecting the repercussions from those things you're claiming. Advertising was always good at, you know, presenting a great story for a brand. But unless that story is real and is grounded, it will be shut down. So, you know, a lot of the tools that have been at advertising's disposal are going to be taken away in this new world. And actually, there's going to be a much more clear and straightforward demand for, you know, truthful brands that actually doing the right thing and telling that story. Just tell the story of the purpose, you know, that this brand exists, the reason why it exists, tell it how it is. That's the kind of brands that we want to work with, the people that are already doing great things, and let's just celebrate the greatness of the things that they're doing, shine a light on the great things, don't cloud it with too much, you know, distraction. That those are the people and the brands that we want to work with.
Perfect. Okay, on that happy note, we'll end it there. But
thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Can you tell the people how they can find you? Like, what are your social media links, contacts, all of it?
So there's only one Dino Myers Lamperty. So if you type it in Google or if you go on LinkedIn, you'll quickly find me that way. There's also, I exist as things like the Dinosaur on Twitter, so at the Dinosaur. And you'll find me in, you know, a few other places like that, like Instagram. But really, from the business perspective as well, the website is wearetbs.com, which stands for We Are the Barbershop. And just drop us an email either through the site or contact me through LinkedIn and connect that way.
Perfect. I'll also put these the links in the description, the show notes, and yes, please get in contact with Dino, get in contact with me, and yeah, I'd like to say, Dino, thank you very much for coming on today. You have been, it's been a joy, it's been a pleasure having you on. Let me just say to all you lovely people who are still listening, watching, I just want to say thank you. Stay well, stay safe, have an excellent day, be well, be awesome, be fantastic, be all the positive bees you can be in this world and more. Anyway, have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And we are